argument this morning is 16-1747, District of Minnesota, Samuel Zien versus Fairview Health Services.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Sean Wanta, counsel for appellant. The district court in this case erred in dismissing appellant's complaint for failure to state a claim. The district court erred in three ways. It disregarded two final orders issued by the Federal Communications Commission that placed the burden of a caller. Oh, sure, Your Honor. The FCC issued two orders, one in 2008 and one in 2015, that placed the burden of establishing prior express consent on the caller of an automated call.
Now, where do we go in FCC materials verify that the agency was talking about the burden of persuasion as opposed to the burden of going forward?
Your Honor, we look at the 2008 FCC order, and we look at the 2015.
I read the quote. I read the 2008 quote in one of the cases. It certainly made no, there was no indication it was addressing the burden of persuasion as anything more than the burden of going forward. In other words, that the agency was suggesting that you can't have a Rule 12b-6 dismissal on this ground.
Well, Your Honor, by placing the burden on the caller, the Rule 8c of the federal rules are incorporated.
There's no reason why an affirmative defense cannot be established sufficiently to justify a Rule 12b-6 dismissal under Iqbal and Twombly.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the burden of the fact that the burden of going forward is on the distinction of which burden they were talking about would say an awful lot about whether they were trying to say that you have to go beyond the pleading stages in these cases. I don't think the agency was thinking about that.
No, Your Honor, I agree. And there's a difference between an agency order. I mean, the agency is interested in the administration of the statute.
There's no ignoring of an agency order which didn't address the procedural question. They just used the word burden. Well, the burden of going forward is almost always on a defendant if the defendant is the one in possession and control of the evidence. That doesn't say anything about the ultimate burden of persuasion, nor does it suggest that you can't have a Rule 12b-6 dismissal under Iqbal in this situation.
Your Honor, and I do agree with that.
Okay.
But that's not the facts of this case, because the court moved on beyond that.
Okay, so your first argument is it doesn't get you anywhere, in my view.
Well, Your Honor, I would reference the Third Circuit case that we cite, which incorporates the FCC 2008 order. That's the Ivankovich.
Well, I read Mays. I didn't. But I don't care if another court read burden to mean what you say it means. But I dare say you don't have a circuit court that's held that you can't have post Iqbal a 12b-6 dismissal. On this basis.
No, and I'm not aware of a circuit court that has. I'm only aware of circuit courts, the 3rd and the 9th and the 11th, that have referenced the 2008 FCC order to conclude that lack of prior express consent is an affirmative defense. And
that doesn't preclude a 12b-6?
No. I agree that it doesn't preclude that. But it does change the burden, and that goes to our second two points, which are let's assume that it is an affirmative defense or that it's an element of the claim. The record here doesn't allow the court to conclude that there was prior express consent. And that's because the court looked beyond the pleadings. It looked to two documents that weren't embraced by the pleadings. And that's important here. The two documents were virtually entirely redacted. And so when we look at the first of the two Rule 12 errors is...
Was the question of whether you waived the HIPAA phrase in the district court?
Whether we raised the HIPAA?
The opposing counsel says, of course, they were redacted because federal law required that for the protection of the plaintiff's health care records, a waivable protection. Was that discussed? Was it discussed in the district court whether the plaintiff was willing to permit unredacted documents in the record?
No, Your Honor, that's not in the record. And I wasn't counsel at the hearing. I've read the transcript. I have available what the court has available. And that's simply not in the record anywhere. But also, I'd also propose to the court that HIPAA doesn't change the Rule 12 standard. The same way Your Honor has stated that the court be skeptical that the FCC changes the Rule 12 standard. HIPAA doesn't change that either. And so looking outside the pleadings, these redacted documents, they are not embraced by the pleadings. They're not mentioned by the pleadings. They're not a public record that's entitled to judicial notice. These are actually documents that we don't agree are authentic. These are documents our plaintiff doesn't know what they are, can't challenge them, can't cross-examine the declarant who offered them to stand what they stand for. And that's a problem. That's a problem under the well-settled law of this circuit, which states you don't look beyond the pleadings.
That authenticity point, that should be raised. That can be raised in the district court. Was it?
It was, Your Honor.
What do I read to get a resolution of that?
Well, it would be in the transcript, Your Honor. I don't have a citation for you at this time. I would say that the fact that there isn't a stipulation as to the authenticity of the document in the record is sufficient to conclude that the plaintiff challenges the authenticity. And so when we're looking outside the record, the redacted documents, even if we say they are embraced by the pleadings, even if we do look at them, and to be clear, the redacted documents are not the documents that would be implicated by the pleadings. The document that would be implicated is an unredacted version. It's a version that allows you to see the context of the consent, because the scope of consent is crucial to the third stage of analysis. Did the defendant act within the scope of consent?
So are you saying that if it was an unredacted version of this purported consent form, that would be embraced by the pleading?
No, that wouldn't be. I'm saying even if this court were to conclude that it was embraced, which it's not, because the underlying documents would be the documents that were embraced, not some version that had cherry-picked redactions, and it's not.
So your position is, one, even if it was unredacted, it's not embraced by, you can't look at it at this stage, but even so, this one is so redacted, you're questioning its validity. Okay, yeah, all right.
Yes, because the 2012 FCC order states that consent for a limited purpose doesn't go beyond that purpose. So even if plaintiff gave consent, and we don't agree he did, you need to see what was the context of the consent. And these documents actually muddy the waters. They don't help the court to determine whether or not the plaintiff gave consent or the appellant gave consent, because they're unclear. They're over a year apart. The original document that the court relied upon that purportedly alleges a cell phone number, and that's nowhere in the record that's plaintiff's cell phone number, but that document was signed over a year before plaintiff purchased the medical device that supposedly gave rise to these numerous telephone calls. 13 months later, plaintiff allegedly signed another document that says Fairview may have a need to contact you about the services provided. So we have that raises questions. One, did Fairview have a need to contact the plaintiff? That can't be inferred from the documents provided. The district court didn't look at that at Rule 12, and it should have. Second, it begs the question, were these calls related to the services that the plaintiff received when he signed that consent? We don't know that. We can't see that from the documents. It's certainly not in the complaint.
It's stated in the complaint.
No, Your Honor. This isn't in the pleadings either. You can't infer this from the record. Plaintiff sought medical treatment, and that resulted in him purchasing a device. Right. There were multiple visits, and
which required replacement services or components.
Well, that's why these documents muddy the water. Is there a need? See, the consent that if the consent you can glean from the document is the need to contact. That's what the scope of the consent is in this document.
Didn't get that out of the box.
Sure. The this is appendix page 41. It's the second page of Exhibit A that the district court considered. It states, I understand Fairview may need to contact me in regard to my services and accounts. And so even taking these redactions, accepting you can embrace this document as a part of the pleadings, which you can't, but if you did, you're left with a few sentences that beg more questions than they answer for the district court. The district court needs to know what was Fairview's need.
Oh, wait, it says accounts, too.
Services and accounts. But these calls didn't relate to the accounts. The calls were unequivocally trying to sell him replacement parts that he could have purchased anywhere. He didn't need to purchase them from Fairview. You can get those at Target. You can get them online. You can get them from another provider. And so by cherry-picking the redactions, we don't have the rest of the consent. We don't know what the scope and what the context of the consent is. And that, the 2012 FCC order says, is crucial to the analysis. I see that I am running into the time I've reserved for rebuttal. If the court has no questions, I'd like to reserve my remaining time.
Very good.
Thank you.
Cheetah, yes, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. The district court's order dismissing the complaint should be affirmed for three independent reasons. The first reason is that by providing his cellular telephone number to Fairview, the plaintiff gave his prior express consent for the very phone calls that are now claimed to be wrongful. The claims were properly dismissed in light of that prior express consent. The second reason that the order should be affirmed is that the plaintiff did not allege below that his prior express consent was given for some limited purpose or revoked before the calls at issue, like we've seen in some of the other district court opinions that are cited declining to dismiss a complaint on Rule 12 grounds. To the contrary, in the briefing below, when presented with consent forms, the plaintiff expressly disavowed in the briefing, and that's at pages 2 and 7 of the memorandum in opposition to the motion to dismiss, making any allegations about there being a lack of prior express consent. And then the third reasoning, whether it's by virtue of the FCC orders not applying to the Rule 12 motion here, or simply the plain language of the TCPA, which to my mind, in my reading of the statute, places this as an element of the claim, prior express consent, rather than an affirmative defense based on the plain language of the statute. So I'd like to start with the first issue, and that is simply what is prior express consent under the TCPA? The great weight of authority that we've cited in the briefing holds that a consumer gives prior express consent by the act of providing the cellular telephone number to the caller. Once you've done that, you've been deemed to have given prior express consent. And that's exactly what happened here. The plaintiff provided a cellular telephone number to Fairview, and not surprisingly, Fairview called Mr. Jean at the cellular telephone number he provided, and that's enough for prior express consent to exist under the TCPA. And that's what Judge Magnuson held in the court below. A word about the scope of consent. There was some discussion and the language that the full language here is, here's what the consent says. I understand Fairview may need to contact me in regard to my services and accounts. And the appellant is arguing that that term need restricts the scope of the consent. I think that the first sentence, though, states the understanding of Mr. Jean, and that's that Fairview may need to contact him with regard to the services and account. The sentence that follows then grants the permission to call, and it says, I give permission for Fairview and its approved agents to contact me by my phone, including my cell phone, period, and this may include the use of automatic dialers or pre-recorded messages. So, yes, there's a premise on need to contact regarding services and accounts, but the permission, the actual language of the permission, has no restrictions on it. And so what do we see that's different in the complaint in this case from those cases like Kolenek, the Walgreens case, declining to dismiss on Rule 12 grounds? In those cases where the district courts have declined to dismiss on Rule 12 grounds, Kolenek is probably the best recent example. The plaintiff there alleged that he provided a cellular telephone number solely for purposes of personal identification. That was an actual allegation in the pleading. And then said, and there were calls that didn't relate to that initial purpose, spelling it out and saying that you violated the TCPA. And the courts there are saying, well, when you've got allegations along those lines, yes, that raises above the standard of plausibility and we'll let that complaint go forward.
How can we know what else? I mean, this document, it's more redaction than substance, clearly. How do we know that those kinds of issues aren't addressed there?
And my response to that, Your Honor, is simply that we have everything we need here to decide the motion to dismiss. The cellular telephone number is provided on Exhibit B. That in and of itself is enough to constitute prior express consent. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
You need to finish the answer.
I was going to say the second document with the language about the broad scope of consent, that certainly helps me talk about the broad scope of consent. But when we're talking about what's the pleading burden, again, I go back to Kolenek. Where's the allegation that I provided my cellular telephone number to you? That piece is, I think, uncontested. We're not saying we didn't give it to you. And by the way, I told you that you couldn't use it for other purposes other than what I gave it to. I mean, we've got the consent language here.
I guess my question is, you've got some consent language, but again, that's the only thing, signature, a date, a number that's not redacted. Did you, to follow up, I think, on what Judge Logan's question related to, did you approach, is it Mr. Jean, about waiving the HIPAA restrictions, filing this under seal in some way so that the court could actually see the entire document?
That question came up briefly at oral argument, Your Honors. Judge Magnuson asked, can't we just file the unredacted document under seal? And my response was, no, I don't think we can. We have to have, first under federal law, under HIPAA, a qualified protective order. And secondly, because HIPAA incorporates the Minnesota Health Records Act to the extent it's more restrictive, and with respect to consent to releasing protected health information, it is, a qualified protective order isn't good enough. You have to have either a specific authorization in law or written consent from the patient. And we don't have either of those here. So the topic did come up, and at that point, to sort of responded Judge Loken's question, you know, was there any offer at that point to say, well, time out, the plaintiff will consent to having the full complete unredacted documents submitted. We could do that under a protective order and move forward with the full document. The issue came up, and that suggestion was not made below. So,
was there any colloquy with plaintiff's lawyer?
There was a colloquy between myself and the judge.
On the record?
On the record between me and the judge, yes.
Did the judge then ask plaintiff's lawyer, or did plaintiff's lawyer volunteer one way or another?
No. Not as I read the record, Your Honors. So I don't know what else to say about the redactions other than without consent or, you know, something specific authorizing us to submit the complete document. We were, I think, understandably very concerned about any allegation that we disclosed protected health information without authorization. And again,
how was the question of authenticity handled? How did that come up?
I don't believe.
Now we can't use this because the redacted form is. We don't concede authenticity.
I don't believe authenticity was raised below, Your Honor. We had the declaration of the Fairview employee stating that this was a business record relating to the plaintiff.
So plaintiff's concession of authenticity. There's more or less a concession of authenticity by failure to pick up on this colloquy or to raise the issue.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. Yes. That would be my argument. But at the end of the day, where this case really is different is what's fundamentally lacking in this complaint is the taking it past that plausibility standard that, I gave the cell phone number, but I did it for some other purpose, and here was the other purpose, and here's why the calls were not closely related to that initial purpose. So unless there are other questions on that issue, I'd like to move on to the issue of whether the district court properly considered the consent forms, putting aside the authenticity question.
Well, what is there any law on this? We go on for pages in the appellant's brief about the FCC saying the consent has to be is a fact question. That's obviously true. Consent for one purpose isn't consent for all. But then, what beyond that have the courts done with? Have there been any court cases that pick up on his argument that you can't make rational inferences without full trial on the scope of consent?
On the rational inferences piece, I'm not aware of any case law specifically outlining the boundaries of that. What I am aware of are the cases that say, yes, consent for one purpose isn't consent for all purposes. And when a plaintiff gets to the level of alleging...
Any cases, any non-creditor cases? This usually comes up.
They usually do come up in... Correct. That is correct.
Consent may have been given for some entirely different thing than allowing the hounding.
That is correct, Your Honor. There are two cases cited in our brief that talk about prior express consent that are healthcare type cases. That would be the Mays case, and then the Murphy v. DCI case. But in terms of how the courts have been treating. You know, did you properly allege that the calls were outside of the original scope of consent? Kolenek is probably the best and most cited, you know, recent example of that, where, again, why that got beyond the plausibility standard was the plaintiff actually delineated, here was the purpose that I gave you the number for, personal identification, and then you called me for an entirely different purpose, which related to, you know, allegedly selling pharmaceuticals.
In that case, was that information within the control of the creditor? Or did the...
And I think that's a distinction, Your Honor, that why would that information not be within the control of the plaintiff? You know, I'm alleging that you're outside the scope of the consent I gave you. I gave you my cell number, and it was for some limited purpose, and you exceeded the scope of the permission I gave to you. I don't see why that wouldn't be within the plaintiff's control to plead in a complaint like we see in Kolenek. So that's how I think those cases are coming down. And here, again, the allegations in the complaint just fall short of that standard. Did I answer your question, Your Honor? Thank you. So did the district court properly consider the consent forms? And what the district court obviously concluded, that's we've argued it, is that the consent forms were embraced by the pleadings. And I think the argument in response was along the lines of, well, because the consent forms aren't specifically mentioned in the complaint, and because they're not attached to the complaint, they're not actually embraced by the pleadings, and they shouldn't have been considered. I don't read the law to be necessarily that restrictive. That's oftentimes how the question of whether the documents are embraced by the pleadings comes up. But I look at the Dittmer case, which we've cited in our brief, and in that case, the court considered a partnership agreement on a Rule 12 motion that was neither attached to nor specifically referenced in the complaint. And the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the district court's consideration of that agreement in connection with a Rule 12b-6 motion because the agreement could be inferred from the allegations in the complaint. So I think there's case law that supports the notion that it's not just those documents that are precisely referenced in the complaint or attached that can be properly considered. And so what the district court did here was infer that the plaintiff provided his cellular telephone number to Fairview for two primary reasons, as I understand them. And the first reason was that the plaintiff in the complaint, and Judge Loken, you were referencing this earlier, I may have been Judge Kelly, but in the specific allegations in the complaint, the temporal nature of how this is set up, so there's a relationship formed with Fairview Medical Services and Supplies. The plaintiff alleged that after he purchased the medical device, Fairview began calling him on his cell phone. So paragraph 10 of the complaint, he purchased a medical device from defendant that requires him to periodically purchase supplies for the continued use. And then followed up on that in paragraph 11 of the complaint, the plaintiff alleged that the Fairview began calling him on his cellular phone, soliciting him to purchase home medical supplies from defendant for that device. And so Judge Magnuson looked at those allegations together and inferred from the allegations that the plaintiff must have provided his cellular telephone number to Fairview in the course of that device and the follow-up on supplies.
Did you have an argument in front of Judge Magnuson or just the magistrate judge?
We argued before Judge Magnuson, Your Honor. I will say that I think I'm advocating that Judge Magnuson got it right, but I think there's enough here in the complaint, frankly, to infer that the cellular telephone number was given to Fairview even without the consent forms, and that's because there is an allegation, the plaintiff alleged that he revoked his consent at some unspecified time. We didn't have any temporal placement of when that occurred, and importantly, the allegation didn't specify whether the supposed revocation of consent occurred before the calls. But I would submit that in order to revoke consent has to have first been given, and that's why that allegation was there. So putting aside the consent forms, which I think were properly considered and pretty clear on their face, there's enough in the complaint to infer prior express consent. And I'm out of time.
Are you aware of a case where a document refuting an element of a plaintiff's prima facie case that is not specifically pled is held to be necessarily embraced by the pleadings?
And is this getting to the question of whether we're disputing the allegations in the complaint with the documents we're bringing in, Your Honor?
This is broader than Dittmer, probably.
I think it probably is, but my answer to that here is, and I think I understand why what happened below happened, we moved to dismiss and attach the forms, and in response to that, you didn't see, let's get the whole forms in, or I'm questioning the authenticity. What you saw was a complete retreat saying, no, we're not making any allegations about the lack of prior express consent. We're not making any allegations. There is in the complaint what I would consider to be a classic kind of threadbare recital that didn't get to the Iqbal Twombly standard in paragraph 40, but in the face of that, when they're saying, no, we're really not alleging that there was a lack of prior express consent, and again, that's on pages 2 and 7 of the briefing, then I don't think, Judge Loken, that implicates the concern about bringing in outside documents to try to contradict the allegations in the complaint.
I meant a prior case where embraced is read that broadly.
I'm not sure there's a case that's exactly on all fours with this one, but I do think the standard with the inference standard in Dittmer is broad enough to take us there.
I think Iqbal has probably, at least implicitly, expanded the notion of embraced.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. And I suppose that, well, thank you very much. I would ask respectfully that the district court's order be affirmed. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
But 3 minutes, Your Honor, to address a few points. First, with respect to the revocation of consent, that doesn't imply that Mr. Zahn ever gave consent. The district court discusses this in the order. What happened is Mr. Zahn called the defendant Fairview and said, "Stop calling me." And they didn't stop calling him. Lawyers call that revocation of consent. The plaintiff wasn't admitting he gave consent in the first place. He called to say stop. Now, moving on to the Fairview's position that providing a telephone number is sufficient to give prior express consent. It's not. And the FCC says so. It's in the 2012 and 2014 order. The 2014 order is the group me order. And again, we just need more information. What was the context?
In healthcare, I thought some of those things were not addressing the special statute for healthcare.
There is an exemption. There is. And so there's two exemptions. So that really implicated at this appeal because the district court didn't analyze them below.
Which was the FCC referring to? Because the nonprofits have a more liberal or generous.
You're right, Your Honor. The nonprofits are not required to get prior express written consent. So verbal consent is sufficient under the FCC orders for nonprofit. Under the health care, there is an exemption for health care calls within the scope of HIPAA. Those are calls about test results or an emergency or something along those lines. But the FCC specifically excluded calls for solicitation, advertising, and marketing, and that's in their 2015 order. While I'm giving citations, Judge Loken, you asked about the FCC orders and the burden of proof. I would direct you to the Grant case out of the Ninth Circuit. That's 449 Federal Appendix at footnote 1. It's a 2011 Ninth Circuit. It is in our brief. And there the Ninth Circuit, it's a footnote, but they do address the burden of proof and specifically state that this is an affirmative defense. The Third Circuit and the Ivankovich case, it's in our brief also, does cite the 2008 order and expressly says it's an affirmative defense. And then there are two 11th Circuit cases we cited as well, but they're not as on point specifically with the FCC. Judge Kelly, you asked about who's in control of the documents. People sign documents all the time. They don't remember them. It's not to say they even get a copy of many of the documents they sign. The fact that it took 6 pages to show a consent in this case, It seems odd to blame the plaintiff for not remembering that at one point he signed a document that purports to be consent, and that certainly shouldn't prejudice him at Rule 12. Finally, the appellant asks that this court reverse or remand to the extent that there are more facts required. We can replead and expressly state he did not provide consent within that scope, but the proper course here is reversal to the district court. I have no further time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. It's been thoroughly briefed and argued, and we'll take it under advisement.